Nothing's ever what it seems. People lie from ear to ear just to help their little teams, which are not what they appear.
Chapter 11. An old expression, used even before the schism, says that people should not see the creation of laws or sausages. This makes sense, as the creation of sausages involves taking various parts of different animals and shaping them until they are presentable at breakfast, and the creation of laws involves taking various parts of different ideas and shaping them until they are presentable at breakfast. And most people prefer to spend their breakfasts eating food and reading the newspaper without being exposed to creation of any sort whatsoever. The High Court, like most courts, was not involved in the creation of laws, but it was involved in the interpretation of laws, which is as perplexing and unfathomable as their creation, and like the interpretation of sausages, is something that also should not be seen. If you were to put this book down and travel to the pond that now reflects nothing but a few burnt scraps of wood and the empty skies, and if you were to find the hidden passageway that leads to the underwater catalogue that has remained secret and safe for all these years, you could read an account of an interpretation of sausages that went horribly wrong and led to the destruction of a very important bath escape, all because I mistakenly thought the sausages were arranged in the shape of a K, when actually the waiter had been trying to make an R, and an account of an interpretation of the law that went horribly wrong, although it would hardly be worth the trip, as that account is also contained in the remaining chapters of this book. But if you were at all sensible, you would shield your eyes from such interpretations, as they are too dreadful to read. As Violet, Klaus and Sunny caught a few winks, a phrase which here means slept fitfully in the closet-sized room 121, arrangements were made for the trial, during which the three judges of the High Court would interpret the laws and decide on the nobility and treachery of Count Olaf and the Baudelaires. But the children were surprised to learn, when a sharp knock on the door awakened them, that they would not see this interpretation themselves.
"Here are your blindfolds,"
said one of the managers, opening the door and handing the children three pieces of black cloth. The Baudelaire suspected he was earnest, as he hadn't bothered to say hello.
"Blindfolds?" Violet asked.
"Everyone wears blindfolds at a high court trial," the manager replied, "except the judges, of course. Haven't you heard the expression, justice is blind?"
"Yes," Klaus said, "but I always thought it meant that justice should be fair and unprejudiced."
"The verdict of the High Court was to take the expression literally," said the manager, "so everyone except the judges must cover their eyes before the trial can begin."
"Scalia,"
Sunny said. She meant something like, "It doesn't seem like the literal interpretation makes any sense." But her siblings did not think it was wise to translate.
"I also brought you some tea," he said,
revealing a tray containing a teapot and three cups.
"I thought it might fortify you for the trial."
By fortify, the manager meant that a few sips of tea might give the children some much-needed strength for their ordeal, and the children thought it must be Frank who was doing them such a favour.
"You're very kind," Violet said.
"I'm sorry there's no sugar," he said.
"That's quite all right," Klaus said, and then hurriedly flipped to a page in his commonplace book until he found his notes on the children's conversation with Kit Snicket.
"Tea should be bitter as wormwood," he read, "and as sharp as a two-edged sword."
The manager gave Klaus a small, unfathomable smile.
"Drink your tea," he said. "I'll knock on a few minutes to bring you to trial."
"Frank,"
unless it was Ernest, shut the door and left the Baudelaires alone.
"Why did you say that about the tea?"
Violet asked. "I thought he might be talking to us in code," Klaus said. "I thought if we gave the proper reply, something might happen."
"Unfathomable,"
Sunny said. "Everything seems unfathomable," Violet said with a sigh, pouring tea for her siblings. "It's getting so that I can't tell a noble person from a wicked one. Kit said that the only way to tell a villain from a volunteer is to observe everyone and make such judgments ourselves," Klaus said. "But that hasn't helped us at all."
"Today the High Court will do the judging for us," Violet said. "Maybe they'll prove to be helpful."
"Or fail us,"
Sunny said. The eldest Baudelaire smiled and reached to help her sister put on her shoes. "I wish our parents could see how much you've grown," she said. "Mother always said that as soon as you learnt to walk, Sonny, you'd be going places. I doubt a closet in the Hotel des Neumonts was what she had in mind," Klaus said, blowing on his tea to cool it. "Who knows what they had in mind?" Violet asked. "That's one more mystery we'll probably never solve." Sonny took a sip of tea, which was indeed as bitter as wormwood and as sharp as a two-edged sword, although the youngest Baudelaire had little experience with metallic weapons or hoary aromatic plants of the composite family used in certain recreational tonics.
"Mama and Papa,"
she said hesitantly.
"And poison darts?"
Her siblings did not have time to answer, as there was another knock on the door. "Finish your tea," called either Frank or Ernest, "and put on your blindfolds. The trial is about to begin." The Baudelaires hurried to follow the instructions of either the volunteer or the villain and took a few quick sips of their tea, tied their shoes, and wound the pieces of cloth around their eyes. In a moment they heard the door of room 121 open and heard Frank or Ernest step toward them. "Where are you?" he asked.
"We're right here,"
Violet said.
"Can't you see us?"
"Of course not," the manager replied. "I'm also wearing a blindfold. Reach for my hand, and I'll lead you to the trial."
The eldest Baudelaire reached out in front of her and found a large, rough hand awaiting hers. Klaus took Violet's other hand, and Sunny took Klaus's, and in this way the children were led out of room 121. The expression, "the blind leading the blind," like the expression, "justice is blind," is usually not taken literally, as it simply refers to a confusing situation in which the people in charge know nothing more than the people following them. But as the Baudelaires learned, as they were led through the lobby, the blindfolded leading the blindfolded results in the same sort of confusion. The children could not see anything through their blindfolds, but the room was filled with the sounds of people looking for their companions, bumping up against one another, and running into the walls and furniture. Violet was poked in the eye by someone's chubby finger. Klaus was mistaken for someone named Jerry by a man who gave him an enormous hug before learning of his mistake. And someone bumped into Sunny's head, assumed she was an ornamental vase, and tried to place an umbrella in her mouth. Above the noise of the crowd, the Baudelaires heard the clock strike 12 insistent wrongs and realized they had been sleeping quite some time. It was already Wednesday afternoon, which meant that Thursday and the arrival of their noble friends and associates was quite close indeed.
"Attention!"
The voice of Justice Strauss was also quite close indeed and rang out over the crowd, along with the repeated banging of a gavel, a word which refers to the small hammer used by judges when they want someone's attention.
"Attention, everyone! The trial is about to begin. Everyone, please take your seats."
"How can we take our seats?" a man asked, "when we can't see them?"
"Feel around with your hands," Justice Strauss said. "Move to your right. Further. 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 Ow!"
"Not that far,"
the judge said.
"There, sit.
Now, the rest of you follow his lead.
How can we do what he did?
Asked someone else. If we can't see him.
Can we peek?
Asked another person.
No peeking,
Justice Strauss said sternly. Our system of justice isn't perfect, but it's the only one we have. I remind you that all three judges of the High Court are bare-eyed, and if you peek, you will be guilty of contempt of court. Contempt, by the way, is a word for finding something worthless or dishonourable.
I know what the word contempt means,
snarled a voice the children could not recognise. I defined the word for the benefit of the Baudelaires, Justice Strauss said, and the children nodded their thanks in the direction of the judge's voice, although all three siblings had known the meaning of contempt since a night long ago when Uncle Monty had taken them to the movies. Baudelaires, take three steps to your right. Three more. One more. There. You've reached your bench. Please sit down. The Baudelaires sat down on one of the lobby's wooden benches and listened to the footsteps of the manager as he left them alone and stumbled back into the settling crowd. Finally, it sounded as if everyone had found a seat of some kind or another, and with another few bangs of the gavel and calls for attention, the crowd quieted down and Justice Strauss began the trial.
"Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen," she said, her voice coming from right in front of the Baudelaires, "and anyone else who happens to be in attendance. It has come to the attention of the High Court that certain wicked deeds have gone unpunished, and that this wickedness is continuing at an alarming rate. We planned to hold a trial on Thursday, but after the death of Mr. Denouement, it is clear we should proceed earlier, in the interests of justice and nobility. We will hear what each witness has to say, and determine once and for all who is responsible. The guilty parties will be turned over to the authorities, who are waiting outside, making sure that no one will try to escape while the trial is in progress."
"And speaking of guilty parties," Count Olaf added, "when the trial is over, everyone is invited to a very inn cocktail party, hosted by me. Wealthy women are particularly welcome."
"I'm hosting it," snarled the voice of Esme Squalor, "and fashionable men will be given a free gift."
"All gifts are free," said either Frank or Ernest. "You're out of order," Justice Strauss said sternly, banging her gavel. "We are discussing social justice, not social engagements. Now then, will the accused parties please stand and state their names and occupations for the record?"
The Baudelaire stood up hesitantly.
"You too, Count Olaf," Justice Strauss said firmly.
The wooden bench crackled beside the Baudelaires, and they realized the notorious villain had also been sitting on the bench and was now standing beside them.
"Name?" the judge asked.
"Count Olaf,"
Count Olaf replied.
"Occupation?"
"Impresario,"
he said, using a fancy word for someone who puts on theatrical spectacles.
"And are you innocent or guilty?" asked Justice Strauss.
The children thought they could hear Olaf's filthy teeth slide against his lips as he smiled.
"I'm unspeakably innocent,"
he said, and murmuring spread through the crowd like a ripple on the surface of a pond.
"You may be seated," Justice Strauss said, banging her gavel. "Children, you are next. Please state your names."
"Violet Baudelaire,"
said Violet Baudelaire.
"Klaus Baudelaire," said Klaus Baudelaire.
"Sonny Baudelaire,"
said Sonny Baudelaire. The children heard the scratching of a pen and realized that the judge was writing down everything that was being said.
"Occupations?"
The Baudelaires did not know how to answer this question. The word occupation, as I'm sure you know, usually refers to a job, but the Baudelaire's employment was sporadic, a word which here means consisting of a great number of occupations held for a short time and under very unusual circumstances. The word can also refer to how one spends one's time, but the siblings hardly liked to think of all the dreadful things that had occupied them recently. Lastly, the word occupation can refer to the state one is in, such as being a woman's husband or a child's guardian. but the youngsters were not certain how such a term could apply to the bewildering history of their lives. The Baudelaires thought and thought, and finally each gave their answer as they saw fit.
"Volunteer," Violet said.
"Concierge," Klaus said.
"Child," Sunny said.
"I object," Olaf said beside them. "Their proper occupation is orphan, or inheritor of a large fortune."
"Your objection is noted," Justice Strauss said firmly. "Now then, Baudelaires, are you guilty or innocent?" Once again the Baudelaires hesitated before answering. Justice Strauss had not asked the children precisely what they were innocent or guilty of, and the expectant hush of the lobby did not make them want to ask the judge to clarify her question. In general, of course, the Baudelaire children believed themselves to be innocent, although they were certainly guilty, as we all are, of certain deeds that are anything but noble. But the Baudelaires were not standing in general. They were standing next to Count Olaf. It was Klaus who found the words to compare the siblings' innocence and guilt with the innocence and guilt of a man who said he was unspeakably innocent, and after a pause, the middle Baudelaire answered the judge's question.
"We're comparatively innocent," he said,
and a ripple went through the crowd again. The children heard the scratching of Justice Strauss's pen again and the sound of Geraldine Julien's enthusiastic voice.
"I can see the headlines now," she cried. "Everybody is innocent. Wait until the readers of the Daily Punctilio see that."
"Nobody is innocent," Justice Strauss said, banging her gavel. "At least, not yet. Now then, all those in the courtroom who have evidence they would like to submit to the court, please approach the judges and do so." The room erupted into pandemonium, a word which here means a crowd of blindfolded people attempting to give evidence to three judges. The Baudelaires sat on the bench and heard people stumbling over one another as they all tried to submit their research to the High Court.
"I submit these newspaper articles," announced the voice of Geraldine Julien.
"I submit these employment records," announced Sir.
"I submit these environmental studies," announced Charles.
"I submit these grade books," announced Mr. Remora.
"I submit these blueprints of banks," announced Mrs. Bass.
"I submit these administrative records," announced Vice Principal Nero.
"I submit this paperwork," announced Hal.
"Submit these financial records," announced Mr. Poe.
"I submit these rule books," announced Mr. Lesko.
"I submit these constitutions," announced Mrs. Morrow.
"I submit these carnival posters," announced Hugo.
"I submit these anatomical drawings," announced Colette.
"I submit these books," announced Kevin, "with both my left and right hands."
"I submit these ruby-encrusted blank pages," announced Esme Squalor.
"I submit this book about how wonderful I am," announced Carmelita Spatz.
"I submit this commonplace book," announced either Frank or Ernest.
"So do I," announced either Ernest or Frank.
"I submit my mother."
This last voice was the first in a parade of voices the Baudelaires could not recognize. It seemed that everyone in the lobby had something to submit to the High Court, and the Baudelaires felt as if they were in the middle of an avalanche of observations, research, and other evidence, some of which sounded exculpatory, a word which here means likely to prove that the Baudelaires were innocent, and some of which sounded damning, a word which made the children shudder just to think of it.
"I submit these photographs. I submit these hospital records. I submit these magazine articles. I submit these telegrams. I submit these couplets. I submit these maps. I submit these cookbooks. I submit these scraps of paper. I submit these screenplays.
I submit these rhyming dictionaries. I submit these love letters. I submit these opera synopses. I submit these thesauri. I submit these marriage licenses. I submit these Talmudic commentaries. I submit these wills and testaments. I submit these auction catalogues. I submit these code books. I submit these mycological encyclopedias. I submit these menus. I submit these ferry schedules. I submit these theatrical programmes. I submit these business cards. I submit these memos. I submit these novels. I submit these cookies. I submit these assorted pieces of evidence I'm unwilling to categorize.
Finally, the Baudelaires heard a mighty thump and the triumphant voice of Jerome Squalor.
I submit this comprehensive history of injustice, he announced,
and the lobby filled with the sound of applause and of hissing as the volunteers and villains reacted. Justice Strauss had to bang her gavel quite a few times before the crowd settled down. Before the High Court reviews this evidence, the judge said, we ask each accused person to give a statement explaining their actions. You can take as long as you want to tell your story, but you should leave out nothing important. Count Olaf, you may go first. The wooden bench crackled again as the villain stood up, and the Baudelaires heard Count Olaf sigh and smelled his foul breath.
Ladies and gentlemen, he said, I'm so incredibly innocent that the word innocent ought to be written on my face in capital letters. The letter I would stand for, I'm innocent. The letter N would stand for nothing wrong, which is what I've done. The letter A would stand for, that's not how you spell innocent, Justice Strauss interrupted. I don't think spelling counts, Count Olaf grumbled.
Spelling counts, the judge said sternly.
Well, innocence should be spelt O-L-A-F, Count Olaf said. And that's the end of my speech.
The bench crackled as Olaf sat down. That's all you have to say? Justice Strauss asked in surprise.
Yep,
Count Olaf said. I told you not to leave out anything important, the judge reminded him.
I'm the only important thing, Count Olaf insisted, and I'm very innocent. I'm sure there's more in that enormous pile of evidence that proves me innocent than there is that proves me guilty.
Well, all right, the judge said uncertainly. Baudelaires, you may now tell us your side of the story. The Baudelaires stood up unsteadily, their legs trembling in nervous anticipation, but once again they did not quite know what to say. Go on, Justice Strauss said kindly. We're listening. The Baudelaire orphans clasped hands. Although they had just been notified about the trial a few hours ago, the children felt as if they had been waiting forever to stand and tell their story to anyone who might listen. Although much of their story had been told to Mr. Poe and noted in Klaus's commonplace book and discussed with the Quagmire triplets and other noble people they had met during their travels, they had never had the opportunity to tell their entire tale, from the dreadful day at Briny Beach when Mr. Poe gave them the terrible news about their parents, to this very afternoon as they stood at the High Court, hoping that all of the villains in their lives would at last be brought to justice. Perhaps there had never been enough time to sit and tell their story just as they wanted to tell it, or perhaps their story was so unhappy that they dared not share all of the wretched details with anyone. Or perhaps the Baudelaires had simply not encountered anyone who listened to them as well as their parents had. As the siblings stood before the High Court, they could picture the faces of their mother and father and the expressions they wore when listening to their children. Occasionally, one of the Baudelaires would be telling their parents a story and there would be an interruption of some kind, the ringing of the phone, or the loud noise of a siren outside, or even a remark from one of the other siblings. Hush, the Baudelaire parents would say to the interruption. It's not your day in court, they would say. And then they would turn back to the Baudelaire who was talking and give them a nod to indicate that the story should continue. The children stood together as the wooden bench creaked behind them and started to tell the story of their lives,
a story they had waited their lives to tell. "Well," Violet said, "one afternoon my siblings and I were at Briny Beach. I was dreaming up an invention that could retrieve a rock after you skipped it into the ocean. Klaus was examining creatures in tide pools, and Sunny noticed that Mr. Poe was walking toward us." Justice Strauss said, but it wasn't a thoughtful kind of hmm. Violet thought perhaps that the judge was saying hmm the way she had said hmm to either Frank or Ernest as a safe answer.
"Go on," said a low, deep voice that belonged to one of the other judges.
Justice Strauss was merely being thoughtful. "Mr. Poe told us that there had been a terrible fire," Klaus continued. "Our home was destroyed, and our parents were gone." Justice Strauss said again. But it wasn't a sympathetic kind of hmm. Klaus thought perhaps that the judge was taking a sip of tea to fortify herself as the siblings told their story.
"Please continue," said another voice.
This one was very hoarse, as if the third judge had been screaming for hours and could hardly talk.
"Justice Strauss was merely being sympathetic."
"Bildungsroman," said Sunny.
She meant something along the lines of, "Since that moment, our story has been a long, dreadful education in the wicked ways of the world and the mysterious secrets hidden in all of its corners." But before her siblings could translate, Justice Strauss uttered another, and this one was the strangest of all. It was not a thoughtful hmm, nor did it sound like a safe answer, and it certainly wasn't sympathetic, or the noise someone might make while taking a sip of tea. To Sunny, the hmm sounded like a noise she'd heard a long time ago, not long after the day on Briny Beach the children were describing. The youngest Baudelaire had heard the same noise coming from her own mouth when she was dangling outside Count Olaf's tower room in a birdcage with a piece of tape covering her mouth. Sunny gasped, recognizing the sound just as Klaus recognized the voice of the second judge and Violet recognized the voice of the third. Blindly, the Baudelaires reached out their hands to clutch one another in panic.
"What shall we do?"
Violet whispered as quietly as possible.
"Peek,"
Sunny whispered back.
"If we peek," Klaus whispered, "we'll be guilty of contempt of court."
"What are you waiting for, orphans?" asked the low, deep voice.
"Yes," said the hoarse one. "Continue your story."
But the Baudelaire orphans knew they could not continue their story, no matter how long they had been waiting to tell it. At the sound of those familiar voices, they had no choice but to remove their blindfolds. The children did not care if they were guilty of contempt of court, because they knew that if the other two judges were who they thought they were, then the High Court was indeed something they found worthless or dishonourable. And so, without any further discussion, they unwound the pieces of black cloth that covered their eyes, and the Baudelaire orphans peeked. It was a shocking and upsetting peek that awaited the Baudelaires. Squinting in the sudden light, they peeked straight ahead where the voices of Justice Strauss and the other judges had come from. The children found themselves peeking at the concierge desk, which was piled with all the evidence the crowd had submitted, including newspaper articles, employment records, environmental studies, grade books, blueprints of banks, administrative records, paperwork, financial records, rule books, constitutions, carnival posters, anatomical drawings, books, ruby-encrusted blank pages, a book alleging how wonderful Carmelita Spatz was, commonplace books, photographs, hospital records, magazine articles, telegrams, couplets, maps, cookbooks, scraps of paper, screenplays, rhyming dictionaries, love letters, opera synopses, thesauri, marriage licenses, Talmudic commentaries, wills and testaments, auction catalogues, code books, mycological encyclopedias, menus, ferry schedules, theatrical programs, business cards, memos, novels, cookies, assorted pieces of evidence a certain person was unwilling to categorize, and someone's mother. all of which Dewey Denouement had been hoping to catalogue. Missing from the desk, however, was Justice Strauss, and as the Baudelaires peeked around the lobby, they saw that another person was missing too, for there was no one on the wooden bench, only a few etched rings from people wicked enough to set down glasses without using coasters. Frantically, they peeked through the blindfolded crowd that was waiting impatiently for them to continue their story, and finally they spotted Count Olaf at the far side of the room. Justice Strauss was there too, tucked in the crook of Olaf's arm, the way you might carry an umbrella if both your hands were full. Neither of Count Olaf's filthy hands were full, but they were both otherwise engaged, a phrase which here means that one hand was covering Justice Strauss's mouth with tape, so she could only say, and the other was hurriedly pressing the button, requesting an elevator. The harpoon gun, with its last hook gleaming wickedly, was leaning against the wall, within easy reach of the treacherous villain. All this was a shocking and upsetting peek, of course, but even more shocking and upsetting was what the children saw when they returned their gaze to the concierge desk. For sitting at either end, with their elbows on the pile of evidence, were two villains at whom the children had hoped very much they would never get a peek again. Villains of such wickedness that it is far too shocking and upsetting for me to write down their names. I can only describe them as the man with a beard but no hair, and the woman with hair but no beard. But to the Baudelaire orphans, these two villainous judges were another peek at the wicked way of the world.